Hello there, you're listening to the Watson's Daily Podcast with me, Peter Watson, on Wednesday the 21st of February. Today, I'm joined by Christian Bland, who is a competition winner.
Hi there, Christian, how are you doing today?
Very good, thank you, Peter. How are you?
This is good. I'm very well, thank you. I'm looking forward to today. Just to let you all know, Christian's going to kick my ass today. So stay tuned because which story did you decide to pick out from today's Watson's Daily?
So the story I chose to pick out from today was the story about Barclays, who are ambitiously hoping to return $10 billion to their shareholders over the next 3 years.
Yep.
On top of the $3 billion they're returning this year, that's going to be a more than double increase on what they've returned to shareholders over the 4 years previous between 2019 and 2022. And their relatively new CEO, C.S. Venkatakrishnan, is planning to do this by increasing revenues by about $5 billion. And then also by trimming operating costs by around about 10%. So just to start with the operating costs, the way this or the method for this appears to be that they're going to divide the bank into five divisions. And then that's going to provide better oversight. And they're going to be able to work those costs down in each division, particularly in the investment bank. And then on the increased in revenue side, there is partly a technical reason for this, which is essentially structural hedges, where some of the benefits that other banks have enjoyed from their net interest margin are basically being deferred, and this is very technical. And then there's also a plan to benefit from a pickup in M&A, which they're hoping for, and that does seem probably quite feasible when you look at the fact their investment banking fees were only about $2 billion in the previous quarter. I think something to mention as well is that they're also looking to grow their US bank and their presence in the US consumer market. And this is something that has been picked up by a lot of analysts as being something that's slightly more questionable in their plans. I'd say it's something quite ambitious to me, Peter. What did you make of it?
Yeah, I mean, I think that this is an interesting story. I think that Barclays itself is is quite an interesting company to follow. So, I mean, I followed it as a competitor. So, you know, when I was in investment banking, and also as a headhunter, in investment banking as well. And it always seems to me that they always seem to me, and it's just a personal opinion, they're a bit higher in fire. They pay quite a lot, they pay quite decently, but then there's always the danger that every few years they will do some kind of massive overhaul and you get the rug pulled from under your feet. I think that they are, they at various times, I think they seem to me to lack consistency maybe over time, because when things are not going very well in investment banking, they say, okay, let's reduce that and we'll just stick with the retail banking and we'll do that. But then when investment banking starts to do well, that means that they're usually then a bit late to the party, which is where the whole kind of, well, let's just chuck a load of money at it, pay people loads, and take whole teams onto our investment banking, platform, and we'll win that way. I don't know. I always feel they're never quite there. They're never, they get on to deals, but they're almost like it's always like they're also rans to me. They're trying to be the British, I don't think Goldman Sachs or Morgan Stanley or something. They're trying to be that, but they never quite get there. And so as a result of that, they're neither one thing nor the other particularly. And this just seems to me to be another another move to try to, you know, sort of jolly things up a bit. But either way, I'm not massively hopeful for them. But yeah, I don't know. Maybe I'm being a bit unfair.
No, I think it's a good point. Before I sort of just like to say, with the stat I gave on the 2 billion, that's 2 billion for the past year on the investment banking, not for the past quarter. So I just misspoke on that one. But with the plans that they're doing, I think it fits quite neatly into what a lot of banks outside the US are doing, where they're looking to basically cut the discount that they trade at to their book value.
Yeah.
And they're doing that by trying to move into areas that give them a better return on equity. And this is something which they do get a better return on equity in the consumer division than they do in their investment banking division, which is quite risky and normally means they have to take on basically lock up a lot of capital under regulatory rules because of the number of risk-weighted assets that they hold in those in that investment banking area. Mm-hmm. So I think the rebalancing does make sense for the shareholders, but I think, as you say, it's not necessarily positioning the bank to make the most of this potential growth that we're going to see in M&A and IPOs in the UK and abroad over the next year. And I think they may regret not maintaining that focus on the investment bank because they've obviously suffered a lot of pain over the past couple of years from that drought. And it's just a question if they're now going to miss out when the market cyclically goes back up again, if they're going to lose that. I think something else I'd just say as well, when you mentioned Goldman Sachs, there is probably a bit of a parallel to that, really. It's a bank with a big focus on investment banking and trading, and it's looking to diversify. And recently they acquired the unsecured lending and credit cards divisions of Tesco Bank in a recent deal. And I think this very much kind of symbolizes that move they're going on, but it didn't work that well for Goldman Sachs. So do you think there's a what do you think the fit with the Barclays DNA will be with this?
I think it'll be a bit better than it, you know, than similar things by Goldman Sachs, because I feel like Goldman Sachs is just investment banking. It's got it running through its veins. That's its thing. I mean, I remember when they launched Marcus. I think it was a thing of the time where, you know, you'd had the financial crisis. Then they were saying that investment banks are taking far too much risk, and this means that earnings are incredibly volatile. And so then having a retail arm, which is much more boring, but, you know, more steadier growth and things, less volatile, is a good thing, right? So it was a thing of the time, but clearly it didn't really work. It's not part of their DNA. Whereas, of course, I think with Barclays, it is a bit more, I would say, with their DNA, because of the history they have with retail banking. And so I think that it might work better, but I mean, I don't know how people are going to perceive this, because going back, one of the reasons why supermarkets decided to do banking in the first place was because they thought, okay, supermarkets in the UK, the whole industry is very, very mature. However, we do, you know, so our growth options are limited. Sometimes they would, you know, do stuff abroad or whatever. But the thing another avenue that they thought they would pursue is to have banks, because they thought, well, we've got a good name. We are accessible by, you know, to our customers. And we can use that name to sell them financial products. And so that went on for a while, but in the end, it all didn't work out particularly well. A lot of the supermarkets are either backed out completely or are in the process of backing out of these things. And I think that actually, you know, banks, it just seems that, you know, Brits want banking done by banks. So maybe that will work a bit better. And I would think it would work a bit better with Barclays than it would, let's say, if, you know, this equivalent happened in America with Goldman Sachs, I'd say.
No, I think you're right on the on this challenger bank where non-bank companies try to move into it because they think they've got a trusted brand. And I've seen telecoms groups do this as well, like Orange had a go at it and didn't really work out, to be honest. I think it's such a complex, it's just such a complex area that it's really hard to run a sort of like a secondary division, especially when you really want to be focusing on. For the supermarket, I think you'd be really wanting to focus on your margin because they're always so razor thin. So I think it is potentially quite a big distraction for the management having something as complex as a bank to run alongside it. I think it will fit better with Barclays. I think there is more of a sort of consumer banking history there than perhaps you have with something like Goldman Sachs, where it was a bit of an about turn. I think they're also looking to grow or revive, I should say, their wealth management business. So Barclays used to have a much greater strength in this area, and then they had to spin off their investment back, not their investment, their wealth management division during the financial crisis period, and it's left them not particularly well diversified. So perhaps regrowing something like that, akin to what a bank like Morgan Stanley have done. Quite successfully,
yeah,
it would be the way forward for them here.
Yeah, I mean, I think wealth management seems to be the way to go. I mean, certainly, you know, that's what's been, you know, that is an area that I have to say, I think it has been growing, and I believe will continue to grow, because I feel that more people are realizing that they have to take more control over their financial affairs rather than just sort of do something and then leave it. And, you know, we've seen, I suppose there was a trend a few years ago where some companies decided to move into robo advice. So where a lot of advice was automated, not robots, you know, sort of, but anyway, it was automated advice. But I think that ultimately, when it comes to, say, planning, particularly if you have I think robo-advice is probably okay if you've got a very simple situation. You know, like you're in a job, you haven't got any assets apart from a house, let's say, and you've got a debt with the car, you paying off your car or something. Then from that aspect, you robo advice may well be enough. But once you start earning more, having more different assets and things, it all starts getting more complicated. Robo advice does not cut it. You need better advice from, you know, qualified advisors. And I think that's, you know, where value add can be, you know, there can be value add. And yes, I think that is a place, that is an area that could be good. And the fact that Barclays are there, everyone knows them, you know, that should be something that they turn to their advantage.
I think I'd agree with that. And I think if you look at another analogy recently that might support that would be Credit Suisse. So when Credit Suisse were going down, they were always emphasizing that they wanted more and more in that wealth management in the period running up to their collapse. And that had been the reason some of their problems was it hadn't been enough focus on that sort of that more boring wealth management side of the banking. And that's what UBS had done so well since the financial crisis.
Yeah.
Much less risky and had just meant that they'd avoided some of the mega financial scandals that Credit Suisse ended up working themselves into. So I think when you look at the Barclays record recently, I think getting away from the investment banking or at least reducing its size of their portfolio would definitely be a good move for them.
There we go. So let's move on to the next topic. So I decided to I'm going to be talking about China paranoia. Right. So from today's, I mean, there were actually quite a few stories that fed into this. So I may mention a few of these things at the same time. So anyway, there is, I mean, it's an amazing headline from the Telegraph, where Renault said the, you know, the car company says apparently Chinese EV invasion must be resisted, right? I mean, this sounds like a very dramatic thing to say, but it seems that it's not just car companies that have been saying this. Remember last year I was referring to household appliance companies that were also saying the same thing, that industries and companies are really concerned about the fact that, you know, there's going to be an influx of Chinese products, whether that is EVs, household appliances, tech generally. I mean, there's just so much paranoia going on at the moment. And I mean, you know, one interesting fact in here was that it said here, so that Chinese EV brands have taken about 10% of the European EV market by the second half of last year. Mm. So, you know, there's a lot of this going on. You've got there's another, you know, there was another thing in the Lex column today about Boeing, you know, Boeing's mishaps, ongoing mishaps, are potentially a gift to China's domestic jet maker Comac. Because it means that it will give them an opening, because customers may think, well, I'm not going to go for, you know, Boeing was always going on about how good its quality was. Well, clearly it's not very good, so we're open to others, and Comac could be, you know, could be their chance. I think that is jets a bit more of a longer term thing, because I think they are very much something that you need to have a lot of trust in. And I think that, you know, Boeing has, although it's had recent mishaps, it has an incredibly long track record, whereas Comac doesn't. And that means that with Comac, you would have thought that that sentiment could be quite fickle. If there is a crash or two, couple of crashes or something happens, by the way, I'm not wishing that to happen at all, but I'm just saying that if it does happen, then suddenly everyone, they'll all cancel and go back to Boeing and Airbus. But anyway, so what I'm saying is the whole theme of, so you've got the you know, car makers being worried about being flooded with Chinese products. You've got the Boeing's mishaps potentially helping China's domestic jet maker. And there's also another thing in there, which is also in the Financial Times as well, which is about how Samsung and LG are now, the situation in display manufacturing is so dire that they are actually going to be working together to produce screens. And I mean, this is because Chinese manufacturers are being able to make display screens at a reasonable quality and much cheaper. And it really reminds me of what basically happened, I think, in the 2000s, when Japan was the big player in display screens, and then they, LG and Samsung, basically took over from that. And now it looks like China is going to overtake from the South Koreans. So there's a general thing here. It seems to me that there's a lot of fear in various industries that China is just going to take over everything, and it's going to render everyone else useless. Now, I believe that there's been enough of a track record of this going on over the years in various different industries that the only way to combat this is to try to put tariffs on Chinese imports. That's one thing. but also to try to give more money in the form of state subsidies to key industries in order to make sure that we still have the capability. And the problem is if we don't, then I think that there is a high chance that history will repeat itself, and some of our industries will be rendered obsolete by the influx of Chinese expertise. Now, I'm not being anti-China. It might sound like I'm being anti-China here. I'm just saying, I mean, they're just being China and they're just advancing and they're just trying to do better. Hmm. The problem is, I would argue, is if we sit back, it's just going to happen again and again and again. You know, we're on the verge of it happening with EVs, and in other areas of technology, it may also happen as well. So anyway, that's my kind of, you know, thought on that. What do you think?
Yeah, I think there is a moderate threat from China. Mm-hmm. But I think the chances of it not being countered are quite low, in my view. Mm. I think the first thing I'd point to is Huawei, with their expertise, one of the most innovative Chinese companies, their expertise in RAM and core, which mm-hmm. was what went into our telecoms towers for 5G at the start. Mm-hmm. The US basically decided that they weren't trustworthy, not based necessarily on a strong smoking gun moment. There was no real gotcha moment. Just decided that they weren't trustworthy, ripped them out of the telecoms towers, and caused immense damage to them as a company, and largely pushed them back away from Europe and the US. So that there's definitely a potential, especially in strategic industries like telecoms, and to really cut China out. And I think cars aren't necessarily as different to that as people, as it might instinctively be thought, because when you think about the Internet of Things working its way into cars, there is a greater degree of connectivity. And I think some of the concerns that were present with Huawei will reappear when it comes to these new EV models. Mm. The second thing that I would point to is that Chinese expertise in chips especially is quite limited. Mm. So they managed to produce a phone. Huawei produced a phone this year, which had 7-nanometer chips, and it produced a bit of a press storm. But you've got to view that in the context that the TSMC chips, which will be used in Apple devices, are 3-nanometers at the moment. So there's, well, the 4-nanometer difference probably doesn't sound that much. Mm-hmm. The Chinese chips are quite seriously inferior. Mm-hmm. They're being built with much weaker technology. They don't have access to the lithography machines from ASML, which is a company that makes these machines that put a circuit board into your silicon chip. Mm-hmm. And this is a monopoly supplier in the Netherlands, and mm-hmm. there's very strong sanctions against China, and it doesn't give them its most recent technology. Mm-hmm. And these machines are very complicated, and it doesn't give them customer support. So that's also a really big problem. And the mm-hmm. amount of their efficiency rates in terms of, you know, converting these circuit boards into workable chips is actually really low. They produce a lot of defective product as well. Mm-hmm. So the cost of doing this is really high, and it's probably being underwritten mostly by the Chinese state. Mm. And when you look at the other pressures on the Chinese state for their money, whether it's subsidizing EVs, whether it's helping local governments out of the absolute hole that they've got into on commercial or just on real estate in China, which is still a quarter of its economy and is just absolutely the real estate in China is just an absolute disaster. It's also been terrible for their perception in terms of getting offshore investment, because the Evergrande liquidation has been a complete debacle. And it was also something, to some extent, a collapse that in many ways was caused by new policies by China, which essentially just pushed it into collapsing. So for those reasons, I just think it will be really hard for China to kind of keep up this real push on technology. And I do think that because it's so opaque, it is hard sometimes to know exactly where it stands on technology. But I wouldn't necessarily be as concerned about the threat it operates. And I'm certain that if it does come to operate a more serious threat, we'll see something akin to Huawei.
Indeed. I mean, I do think that, that China has had this tendency to not be, the technology in whatever industry it may be has lagged. But then the state has thrown enough money at it and enough expertise and effort into it that they narrow the gap much more quickly than everyone seems to expect. And so, like I say, I think that we need to learn from all these experiences. And I think that this needs to be something that is addressed at government level, at, sort of EU or, at a very high level, because otherwise we will continue to see more industries being under the control of, big Chinese companies, solar panels, EVs, all sorts of stuff. But anyway, we'll see what happens. But I think that there is more of an onus on governments to do something about this, because if they don't, there are going to be some very tricky developments. I think
what I would say, just one last thing, is that I think when we're looking at who's right on this, whether it's you or me, I think two things to really watch out for will be quantum computing and GPU chips, the graphics processing unit chips that companies like Nvidia have kind of made a fortune off. I think those will be the two key battlegrounds to watch out for in seeing how big of a threat this is.
There we go. You heard it here. The conflict. and obviously, maybe we'll have to come back in a couple of years' time to revisit this. But anyway, look, Christian, really good fun today. Thank you very much indeed for your thoughts. Thank you very much for listeners for listening. And we'll be back again tomorrow for more commercial awareness, fun and frolics.
Hopefully it won't get too heated.
I don't think it will. It'll be all right. We'll be fine. Anyway, thank you very much indeed. See you. Bye.